both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And we go to the fifth case this morning, U.S. versus Brock. Mr. Schlesinger.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Jeff Schlesinger on behalf of Appellant Ty Brock. Mr. Brock pled guilty to possession of heroin and possession of a firearm after he was stopped at a sobriety checkpoint roadblock in northwest Indiana. The issue upon appeal is the constitutionality of the roadblock. There's no doubt that the use of a sobriety checkpoint constitutes a seizure within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. Because these seizures are accomplished without a warrant, they're presumptively unreasonable. The burden is on the government to show that such a seizure falls within a recognized exception to the warrant requirement. The seminal case on this issue is Michigan Department of State Police versus Sitz, which is a United States Supreme Court case from 1990. I'm old enough to remember that at the time roadblocks were first being used, there was a tremendous amount of publicity regarding them and whether or not they were in fact legal intrusions on individual rights. Since that time, the United States Supreme Court has not directly addressed the issue again. The Seventh Circuit addressed the issue in United States versus Trevino in 1995 and did uphold that particular roadblock to be constitutional. But I believe that many of the safeguards that the court dwelt upon in the Sitz case, the government failed to present evidence to show that those were met in this particular roadblock.
I'm curious, speaking of safeguards, about this opportunity to turn left or right before the roadblock, that there was a warning of some sort, I assume a sign, and with an indication you could go left or right. You wouldn't have to go through the roadblock.
Yes.
So doesn't Mr. Brock consent to the roadblock if he passes that opportunity?
Well, I don't believe that it amounts to a consent to a search or a seizure for that matter. There is some
maybe
Indiana,
not that, but a consent to go through the roadblock if you've got a choice.
Well, to my knowledge, there's no case law on regarding consent to the roadblocks by the individual people stopped. The issue is whether the roadblock is the Supreme Court addressed that and sits and talks about the three-pronged test.
Yeah, you know, it's one thing to announce we're going to do some roadblocks this weekend, and if you go out and drive, then take that risk, I suppose. But it's really much more direct if you have a sign that says roadblock ahead, you can turn left or right, or you can go through the roadblock.
Correct. But I don't believe that issue is that important in this case, and there is Indiana state law, and actually in the Sitz decision, they talk about the fear and surprise engendered in the general public if they don't know that a roadblock is there. So obviously that would minimize that concern, but I still don't think that addresses all of the concerns that the Supreme Court set forth in Sitz.
Well, that would eliminate the concern. I mean, the sign eliminates the concern because you have a choice. So what's unlawful about, you know, assuming like here, once they stopped him and they smelled everything, I mean, it's a real problem. I agree with Judge Tender. I mean, he's given an option here.
Well, I'm not sure from the evidence at the suppression hearing whether Mr. Brock saw that sign. I don't think there's any dispute that in fact it did exist. This was at night on a relatively, I don't think it was particularly well lit. I don't think that the issue, the government really never raised consent as an exception regarding the roadblock, although there was evidence on the aspect that he had the ability to turn around, but I think that only goes to the fear and surprise engendered in the general public and would certainly minimize that issue, but we don't believe that that's determinative. It probably means that you're going to get more stupid people with narcotics or who are drunk driving, but there's never been a reported case in a federal system that holds that amounts to consent, to my knowledge.
So what more do you think they could have done to make this appropriate other than stopping every car? I mean, I know you advanced that as
Well, that is addressed in the Sitz decision, and specifically there's the three prongs that the court identifies as the tests that have to be met. The first is the state's interest, and we have conceded consistently that the state has an interest in preventing drunk driving. There's no evidence presented that before the trial court, but we would concede that. In some of the other cases, there was evidence presented. Also, there's the level of the intrusion, which was addressed at the trial level and has been addressed in the appellate briefs. We believe that the intrusion was somewhat greater than Sitz. I know the government's contention is that it was not. In this case, the cars were waved into a separate area rather than just stopped on the roadway and interrogated. I don't think that's determinative either. What I believe would be determinative is the third prong, the effectiveness of sobriety checkpoints, which the government presented no evidence on at the before the trial court. And one of the concerns in Sitz, and of course Sitz was somewhat of a did not overrule Delaware v. Proust, but it addressed a similar issue because in Proust, the Supreme Court had held that random stops were not constitutional, and Sitz did carve out this exception. But what Sitz addressed was the fear that individual officers might do this in a more random fashion, and therefore they wanted subjective evidence that the stops were effective, they were conducted in a neutral manner. I know the officers in this case testified that they did, but they also testified that these checkpoints were established by a task force headed by an officer, Rudzinski, who never testified at this hearing. There were no written guidelines. There's no evidence of who was on the task force. In the Sitz case, the Supreme Court talked in great detail, and apparently there was more than a day of evidence presented that how these checkpoints were established. Specifically, there was a sobriety checkpoint advisory committee consisting of representatives from state police, local police, state prosecutors, and the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute to establish the location, the site, and duration of the checkpoints. And these procedures were utilized by law enforcement. We have no evidence of the procedures in this case other than before this case, the officers all got together in a shelter in a forest preserve out close to the location. They had donuts, and the officer Rudzinski advised them of what procedures they were going to follow tonight. I don't believe that a day's testimony is necessary to establish that there is some rationale for establishing the checkpoint at the time and place that they decide. But there's some evidence should be submitted, whether they're written guidelines or who's on the board and how these are communicated to the officers.
Well, there was some evidence. I mean, indicating the Rudzinski directed and told them about the way it was going to take place.
Right. Well, I don't think that's sufficient, though, Your Honor, with all due respect. The Officer Lewis and Officer Ozutz testified at the hearing, and they did say that the normal procedure was between 6 and 8 cars would be turned aside into the checkpoint area, and 6 or 8 would stop. But neither one was exactly sure at this time how many cars were going to be stopped. Also, I believe Officer Lewis testified that it was left to the discretion of each individual officer how they were going to approach the people, what they were going to ask, and what they were going to determine. The fact that in the last 20 years now that police agencies appear to feel that as long as there's a roadblock and it's neutral, it's constitutionally acceptable, and I don't think that's the holding in Sitz or even in Trevino.
Well, was Officer Lewis the primary person asking the questions at the stop?
Yes.
So he was following a procedure, at least as I understood it. He introduced himself. He said he was conducting a roadblock. And then he asked for license, registration, and proof of insurance.
Correct. But when I asked him whether that was an established procedure, he said, that's the way I do it.
Right, but he was the only one doing it.
No, there were others.
And that's why I asked you the question.
I'm sorry.
He was the only one that did the initial stop and asked the question.
So he said there were 6 to 8 officers, I believe, who were all in the area.
Yeah, I was wondering whether he was the lead. In other words, that whenever they stopped, they got him, so he was doing it. So he explained, though, to them these questions. Was that in the record? That they were supposed
to. He asked the motorists those questions.
Right.
But that was his, it appeared to be his decision. That was not part of the guidelines. In fact, as I recall, when I asked him if that was a guidelines, he said, that's the way I do it. And he did indicate that the I'm not sure if anybody knew exactly how many officers were there, but the team was broken into officers who would wave motorists into the area. Then I believe there were 6 to 8 officers who would, because there were 6 to 8 cars, I would assume each car was approached by a different officer, would go ahead and talk to the driver. And then there were other officers who could kind of roam around, and Officer Ozist was one of those who could determine if they wanted to approach another car for additional investigation. And again, that appears entirely within their discretion.
Now, these roadblocks were set up about 1 weekend per month at different locations in Lake County, correct?
Yes, that was the evidence. But, again, there were no guidelines presented or how that was determined. I'm out of time, so I will, unless there are any other questions.
Thank you, Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Nozick on behalf of the government. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in Indiana Northern District. I believe that both parties are in agreement that a stop and a seizure occurred here, and I believe that we all agree as to what the seminal cases are that this court should look at. That is the Sitz case by the United States Supreme Court and the Trevino case by this court. Both of those cases stand for the proposition that the court should apply a balancing test. What the courts look at is they balance the intrusion on the defendant's rights or the defendant's privacy versus the promotion of a legitimate government interest. There is no issue in this case as to whether or not there's a legitimate government interest. The Sitz case, the Supreme Court said the government has a very substantial interest in eradicating drunk driving, and defense counsel has stipulated today and in his brief that that there is this legitimate government interest. So then the only question remains for the court is whether the intrusion outweighs the legitimate government interest. The cases, both the Sitz case and the Trevino case, held that the court should look at, when they look at intrusion, they should look at both the subjective intrusion and the objective intrusion. I would submit and argue strongly that Judge Simon did not err in finding that that this was a constitutional stop, that the roadblock was not unconstitutional, and that the intrusion did not outweigh the promotion of the legitimate government interests.
You don't disagree that there were not written guidelines, right? There were no written guidelines.
There was no testimony about written guidelines, Your Honor. However, there was testimony that this was a DUI task force that they had. These were officers trained both in drunk driving enforcement, but also trained in the rules that they should have for the various roadblocks. So this wasn't
A number of different sheriff's offices and city police?
Yes, it was, Judge. It was St. John's Police and, you know, various municipalities and maybe the county. And they had been trained by Officer Ruzinski. And there was testimony, and I don't know if the guidelines were written or just oral. There was no testimony on that, but they said that they were trained. And, of course, none of the cases hold that there has to be written guidelines given to them. I questioned the officers, Officer Lewis, and I believe Ozust also, in this training, was, you know, did the training, were you mindful of Indiana state law on drunk driving and on traffic stops and roadblocks? They said yes. One of the main things that they got in the training was that they have to have a pattern of the cars that they're stopping. Of course, we don't want cars being stopped in a random, haphazard manner, or worse, in a discriminatory manner, where people are being stopped based on age profiling, racial profiling, et cetera. Stepping back a bit, there's nothing whatsoever in the record to show that the stop was either subjectively overly intrusive or objectively overly intrusive. Looking at the objective one, well, first of all, as two of you identified, the drivers driving towards the roadblock were notified of it and given an option.
What's the origin of that? Was that state law that required that? Or
I don't believe it was required in state law, but they said that they had that. They testified that they had that in all of the roadblocks.
And how was that conveyed? By a sign or an officer standing there? Or what?
There was, I believe, a sign, flashing lights and a sign, and there was an actual right turn. They set it up in a spot so that there would be a right turn, left turn there before they got to the roadblock once they saw the roadblock. Whether there was a sign or not, I'm not positive, Judge, but the officers both testified that it was clear that drivers driving into the roadblock had the option of opting out, as we would say, and taking a right or left turn before driving into the roadblock. So both you and Judge Williams identified that as a key point, and we didn't argue. I saw no cases that that stood for the issue of consent, that drivers consent.
There have been cases, however, where the opt-out car gets stopped. And
That I have not seen, Judge, and there's been no testimony of that.
You trusted us.
I don't question you on that. I have not seen those cases. However, we're not arguing the consent issue, but the opt-out is a huge issue for both the objective and subjective test. So objectively, Judge Simon held, and he was correct in holding, it was not objectively intrusive in that the questioning was short. Probable cause was developed right off the bat when they smelled the marijuana when he rolled down the window. But for all of the, the standard stops, the questioning is short. They're simply asked, can I see your license? Can I see your registration? And it's not overly intrusive. They're not asking, where are you coming from? Do you do drugs? Are there any drugs in the car? It's simply license and registration. And he also focused on the fact that they could opt out before getting to the stop. Subjectively, it also wasn't overly intrusive. What the courts hold is the subjective test isn't whether it puts fear or alarm in the average drunk driver or driver with heroin in his car and a gun on his ankle. It's whether it puts any fear in the average law-abiding motorist. And what we have here and what we look at is, one, they could opt out, so there's no real potential for fear. Two, there's a pattern for how they are doing the stops. No one wants to feel that they're being randomly or haphazardly stopped or discriminated against, but here they would stop eight cars, let eight cars go, stop eight cars, and let eight cars go. So there's no real fear that was put in drivers' minds, and also the officers were, of course, in marked cars and uniforms.
So there were oral instructions. Officer Rudzinski gave them specific instructions on how many cars they should pass, how they should stop them, how many to stop for inspection, trying to avoid a discriminatory execution of the...
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. I don't believe he necessarily told them, stop eight, let eight go, but he told them there has to be some pattern so it's not random and possibly discriminatory. So, yes, there were oral instructions on that. There's nothing in any case that I've seen or any case cited by defense counsel which says that the instructions have to be written. The fact that two officers approached the car, Lewis and Ozus, doesn't make it any more... unconstitutional. There's nothing cited to by defense counsel which says that is impermissible. In sum, there's nothing whatsoever to show that it was either objectively or subjectively overly intrusive or that the intrusion outweighed the legitimate government's interest. If the court has no more questions, I'll rest on my brief.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Professor, you're out of time, but I'll give you another minute if you have anything you want to add.
Just briefly, Your Honor. In response to Judge Williams' question, of course, the officers all had their individual recollections, and I think that's where the problem lies. Mr. Nozick has indicated certain things that people perceive, but we're getting down to the perception of individual officers again, and the government still has not offered any rationale for establishing the site duration of the checkpoints. Thank you.
And you were appointed as well in this case, and the court expresses its thanks for you taking the case and the fine representation of your client. Thank you. Proceed to the last case.